Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is made possible in part each Wednesday by People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do, a better business relationship. By Business Energy Action, challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. By Fairpoint Communications, small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. By Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. And by National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years, working for a better tomorrow. And by the over 1,000 VBSR members. Here's noted Vermont author David Goodman.
Welcome to this week's Vermont Conversation, where this week we are broadcasting live from the 24th Annual Spring Conference of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, which is taking place today at the Davis Center at the University of Vermont. I have to say it has been never a dull moment here and fascinating to go around to literally dozens of workshops and talks that are going on simultaneously on everything from strategies for reducing transportation costs to a workshop on bringing your business problem to some of the gurus, Vermont's gurus of this, to some of the topics that, here's one on magical workplaces, creating organizational cultures that attract and engage. So there's a little something for everyone. Today we're going to be talking in the first half hour with three entrepreneurs who work in worker-owned cooperatives here in Vermont and get their perspective on alternative ownership. In the second half hour, we'll be talking to Elisa Gravitz, the CEO and president of Green America, a national organization working on sustainable business. But just to start us off here, we're going to welcome Scott Buckingham from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility to just tell us a little bit about how the day is going here. And Scott, it's certainly there's a very full grand room full of people here. Where are people coming here from?
Yeah, David, thanks for having us on. Well, we've got folks from, of course, all across the state. Most of our membership, and it's most of our members that are here, actually, are the primary attendees. But we've got some folks from beyond our own borders, of course. But it's great. We've got people coming from all corners of Vermont for this spring conference, which is our sort of signature, sort of key conference of the year. And is really our forum and theater for advancing conversations and offering some educational opportunities for our members and other interested parties. And so far, it's been a great day. I've been thrilled to have all the good energy in the building, and everything seems to be coming together fantastic. And we've got great folks doing 15 different workshops, as you said, and we've got three of them sitting right here with us right now. So it's been a great day.
One of the things that is striking to me, you know, in commenting on just the scale, the number of people here. So this morning's keynote was Congressman Peter Welch. And one of the points he was making was that, you know, in Vermont, when you want to talk to the business community, you come to the state's Business for Social Responsibility group. You know, in other states, social responsible business groups are a pretty small gathering of people who either know one another or are related to each other. How did this happen that in Vermont we have, I mean, VBSR is over 1,000 businesses, right?
Right, we've got 1,000 member businesses, and we have the second smallest state in the nation, yet we've got the largest state-based business association organized around principles of social responsibility and sustainability in the nation. So that's pretty incredible in and of itself. But to the second part of your question, VBSR started about 24 years ago, and a lot of the founding energy really was what I would call the forefathers, and if I may, foremothers of our contemporary social responsibility movement. You know, we've got Will Rapp and Pat Heffernan and Ben and Jerry's that really changed the narrative in the state and in the country. But the fact that we had so many thought leaders and business activists, if you will, coming from Vermont, it's really sort of been built into, I think, our contemporary culture and certainly in our business community. It's been amazing. I was involved with VBSR a little bit 24 years ago when it was getting started. To see it go from an organization of 60 sort of activists, easily accused of being sort of hippy-dippy sort of trade association, to now being one of the three largest statewide business organizations in Vermont, which allows us to advance different types of legislation and different types of narratives in the business community, and hopefully over time sort of change the calculus of how business is done.
Well, in the second half, we'll talk to Elisa Gravitz from Green America and get her sense of what it, you know, what Vermont's influence has been nationally. She's with a national organization, but she alluded to that in her talk. So, well, thanks, Scott Buckingham from VBSR, for giving us that kind of global overview. And with no further ado, we'll turn to some of the presenters who have been speaking at the conference today. One of the workshops was on alternative ownership, exploring worker-owned cooperatives. And we have three business people and members, parts of cooperative-based businesses here in Vermont. Kelsey Hanna-Barrows is from the Web Skillet Cooperative. Becca Mandel, also from the Web Skillet Cooperative. And Daniel Shearer from Tamarack Media Cooperative. So I'm going to start with Daniel here, because tell us a little bit about Tamarack Media.
Thanks. So Tamarack is a small cooperative helping build communication tools for environmental initiatives.
And you began as not a cooperative business, sort of a traditional owner, you know, single owner-based or partner-based business.
Right. We had two partners who put the business together almost a little over 10 years ago now, and that actually worked quite well, but over the last year, we're now four full-time employees. We have several other folks that we work with on project basis and collaborate with. And we began to think that in many ways we already function somewhat as a cooperative, and it would make sense to take that step to actually incorporate as one. And that's what we've done this year, and now we're about 6 weeks in.
Tell me about the transition from non-co-op to co-op and some of the challenges of doing that, and you know, some of the benefits that you've realized on the other side of that.
Sure. Well, overall, it was relatively simple, I think. It was a matter of creating a new business, having it buy the previous business. Business-wise, things stayed pretty similar. Our clients are the same, so that transition was pretty smooth. But there were some details to figure out in the actual creation of the new business, such as bylaws and what is the cooperative going to look like, and you know, the direction that we're going. How is this going to really inform us as a business and help us make our business decisions going forward? And I'd say some of the tricks of that were some interesting conversations that inspired. Included thinking about our own compensation, and would new members of the cooperative start at the same salary as people who had been there for 10 years, or would we have a tiered rate of compensation? We decided to, after a lot of discussing, move in the direction of everybody would always be compensated at the same rate, and really try to value, if we're going to hire somebody, we're hiring them because they are valuable to this business moving forward.
So you would take a kid out of college and he would make what you would make?
If they had the right experience that we needed as a business, that would make our business earn more money. We really wanted to distance ourselves from looking at it in the sense of what's the minimum amount we can pay you as an employee to keep you here and the maximum we can profit off of what you'll earn for the company. Rather, everybody is putting in 40 hours a week or more. Everybody is earning for the business and should share equally, because our expectation is that you're all working, you're all making this a successful endeavor.
And how did your role in the business change from before and after? Who were you before in the business and who are you now?
So before, I was one of the two employees. structurally, the way that Bill and Pete, the two partners, had treated everything, it was very little difference between before and after as far as governance. From the day I came on, I had pretty thorough involvement in the decisions of how things were going. So we kind of operated as that already. So in a way, that was just noting that significance, and it's transitioned, you know, pretty seamlessly in that regard. I think for any other organization that didn't already function that way, then it would be a lot more thinking about cultural change and how do we really involve everybody and get everybody to be on board as equal owners and informing how to move forward and making decisions.
Is this part of how you present yourself as a business, or is it just kind of a back office thing that's invisible to your clients?
For the nature of our business, we don't advertise and we don't do a lot of promotion in that sense, so we haven't really thought or spent a lot of time thinking about this as a promotional designation or of any kind. We will mention it to our clients. In fact, during the transition period, I would talk to a lot of our clients about what we were going through just to keep them up on that change for us, and they had questions about it. Most of the people we work for are nonprofits, but we do work for a couple businesses, and in general, everybody thought it was a cool idea and wanted to learn more about what it was like for us to go through that transition and what was coming out the other side. But as far as the client experience, on their end, I don't think that there's really any tangible difference between the services we're providing at this point.
Well, let me move over to Becca Mandel from WebSkillet Cooperative. Becca, tell us a little bit about your business.
Great. Thanks, David. So WebSkillet, we've been incorporated for 3 years. There are now six of us who are member and workers at the cooperative. We started out with just two worker owners back 3 years ago. And what we do digital strategy and website development for mostly social movement organizations, so national nonprofits, folks who are doing work organizing people in communities that are affected by different kinds of injustices. And so we do long-term work with folks all over the country. We might help them roll out a digital strategy around a campaign and walk them through it and actually implement that. And then we also build websites sometimes for some of these organizations.
What made you decide? You were established as a cooperative. What made you decide to start out in that formation?
Well, that's a great question. I don't think it ever occurred to us to do it any other way. It was me and the other original founder, Jonathan Kassam. And we knew that we were going to be working with social justice organizations and nonprofits all over the country, and we really felt that being a cooperative would help us to relate to those clients and also to create the kind of community and the kind of world that we wanted to live in. We felt that being a cooperative was an essential part of that. We wanted to have a democratic workplace.
What does that mean to you, a democratic workplace?
A workplace where everyone's voices are heard and decisions are made on a one-person, one-vote basis. So that's one of the core principles of being a worker cooperative, is that each person gets a vote. And different worker cooperatives are set up differently. You know, in Spain, in the Basque region, there's a worker cooperative that employs, I think, 180,000 people as a minimum.
The Mondragon Cooperative.
Yeah, Mondragon.
Yes,
so they're not...
The grand... parent of all co-ops.
Right, and they're not voting on what they're going to have for their staff lunch on a one-person, one-vote system, right? But the way that decisions are made, there is a representation of each person at every decision. So whether they're voting on someone who's going to then make decisions and get delegated to make those decisions, or whether folks are actually making them one-person, one-vote, we still operate on a one-person, one-vote level. There's six of us, so you know, it's a very direct democracy. It means that when we're going to decide to take on another hire or decide to change our office space or any of these things, or decide to take on a new client or change our business model in, you know, our business plan in some way, we have a conversation and try to come to a consensus and have a process that's accountable to each of us in that way.
Well, let me ask Kelsey Hannah Barrows, who is also with the WebSkillet Cooperative. Kelsey, how do you differentiate your job at WebSkillet from Becca's job?
Well, I guess in terms of our jobs, I don't think there's that much of a difference. I think the only difference right now is that I'm an employee and I'm not yet a worker owner. At Web Skillet, we have a six-month probationary period. I'm at month five. So in about a month, then it becomes a decision for the rest of the worker owners if they would like to extend the ownership to me.
So as somebody who's new to this business, what drew you to a cooperative-based business?
You know, at first it was definitely kind of a culture shock. Coming from traditionally structured businesses where I had a voice in some capacity, but that voice didn't really carry any weight. So I learned pretty quickly here that, you know, what I was saying was being heard and it was being considered and that I did have a vote. I am 1/6 of this business, which means I am 1/6 of every decision made in this business. And it immediately showed me that I don't think I can go back to a more traditional business model, knowing that I'm valued here. I don't think I could lose that.
Well, let me ask Becca Mandel from Web Skillet Cooperative. So having done this now for 3 years, there are some perils of cooperatively run businesses, which is sometimes it can be really hard to make a decision. Talk about the joys and sorrows of consensus or cooperative decision making.
Sure. It's hard stuff, right? And I think it's one of those, it's a practice, and it's something that we all don't have a lot of experience with in the rest of our lives. We sort of, like Kelsey was saying, we often come up in our professional life in hierarchical workplaces. Our schools are very hierarchical. Our experiences outside of work are very hierarchical. And so we don't have a lot of practice. And democracy is hard. It's not easy. It's not something that we're good at necessarily. And so we've done a lot of learning together and made mistakes and things we'd like to do differently next time. But that's part of the process, I think. And one of the things that we make sure to do is really sort of assess after things happen. You know, did that work? Was that what we should have done? Do we want to do that the same way next time? And it's a constant learning process. But for the most part, we're small enough and we have developed a shared culture that does allow us to come to consensus pretty easily. And I think one of the things that we're curious about is how that's going to change as we grow. We have big dreams at Web Skillet, you know, of not maybe world domination, but we'd like to keep growing. And so as we grow, we're going to have to start thinking about, you know, what does a management structure look like? Are we going to need that? And how do we make decisions democratically in a space where there's actually like a different sort of management team?
How do you deal with the issue that Daniel Shearer was talking about at Tamarack about compensation?
So we're also all paid exactly the same at Web Skillet. And then at the end of the year, we divide the profits as patronage refund for worker owners. So for Kelsey, you know, if she becomes a worker owner in a month, she wouldn't receive a full year's worth of the patronage refund, but she would receive half of it. So employees don't share in the profits. They get to share in the decision making, but until you're an owner, you don't get to share in the patronage refund. So we all get paid the same.
Let me ask Daniel Shearer from Tamarack Media Cooperative. Before going on here, I was talking to a VBSR member of a firm that I'm not sure how many. They employ several dozen people, and they're considering switching to a co-op. So I asked her, well, what would your question be? And she said, well, first of all, I would like to know, she said, in my business, there are kind of the, you know, very engaged people who are quick to make decisions and kind of natural leaders. And then there are people who are, you know, just better at kind of doing the job but not thinking big picture as much. So her question was, how do you decide who are the key decision makers in this structure when you're transitioning from conventional to co-op?
That's a great question. As a business of four, you know, the four of us come around the table, around the call. Actually, added trickiness to that is that one of us is in London, two are here in Burlington, and one is in Indiana. So we're kind of a Vermont-born business, but based on the lives of each of each of our worker owners now, we've scattered around. But we're still able to talk every day and talk through those important decisions. And what we've done to facilitate that and make sure that not everyone is trying to not only make every decision, but also think through all the background steps of it, is to be quick to divide responsibilities of who's driving what. And we'll often do that based on people's backgrounds, interests, skills, and experiences. So when we needed to draft bylaws, Bill was the person who took that on, working with Don Jamieson at the VEOC and with our lawyers to make sure that we were putting that together, and then he gave that to all of us to review. So that gives a picture of through the transition. I would say it's very easy with just the four of us. I think talking about a business with several dozen people, it is a very different animal, and my guess is that they already know how to, you know, I think there's certainly a change, but thinking about that bigger management structure, I think some of the same people are going to be very informative in making the decisions and just have to grow to learn how to effectively incorporate input and identify the things that are important for everybody to have comprehensive input on and set up the system to allow for that.
Becca Mandel, are co-ops for everyone?
I feel like that's a leading question, and I say yes. I think the democratic ownership model is one of the most effective ways, I think, that we have in our communities to lift up everyone economically, to make sure that people are involved in their communities and connected to their neighbors, that we are living a more sustainable life. And so, you know, I think if you look at Mondragon and some of these really big co-ops all over the world, they can work. And, I think we have this idea that co-ops are sort of a fringe thing at the grocery store, and maybe they smell like patchouli. But that's a very limited view of what a co-op workplace can be, and they are for everyone. And I think one of the things that's really important about co-ops is that they offer people a chance to grow and learn in a way that will make them more effective members of their community. And it does take more leadership development, right? We think that's a good thing at WebSkillet, and we think that that's a real opportunity for us to lift everyone up.
And I think, contrary to popular belief about what co-ops are, I think the largest co-op in the country is REI, isn't that right?
Yeah, they are a huge co-op.
Which is,
co-op.
You know, a national outdoor goods retailer.
Yeah.
One of the oldest and biggest here. Kelsey Henna-Barrows, if you were counseling others who were starting out and considering, going to work in a co-op business, what would your advice to them be about the upside and downside of it?
To be open-minded. I think if you've been in a more traditional structure most of your life, which most of us are, even going through college. I'm just a few years out of college, but even through that experience, we were taught in a way that was going to introduce us into an environment that was very hierarchical. So I think my main advice would be to be open-minded and embrace it and not be afraid of it, because it is challenging. It forces you to be open and honest and have clear channels of communication with everybody you're working with, which I think is hard sometimes, but if you open up to it, it's amazing what the benefits are.
And what are the benefits in your view?
Just self-growth. I mean, I can't believe how much my creative edge has improved since being with a co-op, and everything is done together. It's not, I don't feel locked into one position where I'm on my own and I have to make my own decision. I feel like I'm able to bounce ideas off people. I'm able to just really get a feel for what works best for everybody, and it just opens the horizons to new ideas, and it keeps me thinking.
Hmm. Okay. Well, we're coming to you live this week from the Spring Conference of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, and we've been talking about alternative ownership with Daniel Shearer from Tamarack Media Co-op, Becca Mandel from WebSkillet, and Kelsey Henna-Barrows from WebSkillet. I want to thank all of you for joining us on this week's Vermont Conversation, and we'll be back in the second half hour with Lisa Kravitz from Green America. Stay tuned.
802cars.com represents the top three selling brands in Vermont, just off exit 7 of I-89. 802 Toyota sells Vermont's number one brand. Twin City Subaru sells Vermont's unofficial state car. 802 Honda sells Vermont's number three brand. This is Dave Birmingham, chief cook and dog walker. When you come to any of our dealerships, you'll be able to find the vehicle you want at the price you want. 802cars.com offers what no other dealer can. One-stop shopping for Vermont's top three brands, all just off the interstate. We'll help you find the right vehicle that fits your budget. Don't forget, we're the largest seller of certified used cars in Vermont because we all know the best new cars make the best used cars too. So click on 802cars.com for information on all our great products. Call 229-9117 and speak to one of our low-key product specialists. Drive I-89 to exit 7. We're just a minute off the interstate. 802 Toyota, Twin City Subaru, and 802 Honda. Driving to be Vermont's number one auto solution.
AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire. Anger and grief boiled over into a violent protest in the Turkish mining town of Soma. That's where at least 245 people have died in a coal mine explosion and fire. Police dressed in riot gear, armed with water cannons, clashed with the protesters outside the ruling party's offices in the city. The protesters blame the government for the explosion and fire. Relatives and others stand vigil outside the mine as the injured and dead are removed by rescue and recovery teams. Risk assessment consultant Sally Lively tells Sky News that miners in Turkey face some of the greatest dangers.
This scale of loss in a modern industry is absolutely unprecedented. And under no circumstances can this be said to be a fact of life of modern mining. So the investigation will be supremely critical of those conditions.
Turkey's energy minister says the hopes of finding anyone else still alive are dim. AP Update, I'm Tim McGuire.
A Saturday special. Be one of the first 40 to ask for a free quart of Easy Care satin paint at Waterbury True Value. Get inspired by our new paint center. It's designed to help you choose colors that reflect the way you live, quietly, boldly, playfully, or even dramatically. You'll find thousands of colors in coordinating palettes. Once you choose your color, trust our low VOC Easy Care paints to get the job done and get a free quart of paint at Waterbury True Value. Behind every project is a true value.
Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility makes the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman available each Wednesday, along with People's United Bank. Find out what know-how can do. A better business relationship. National Life Insurance, for more than 150 years working for a better tomorrow. Fletcher Allen Healthcare, in service to the patient, community, and medicine since 1879. Fairpoint Communications. Small business owners make it big with Fairpoint. And Business Energy Action. Challenging businesses to reduce energy consumption. It's just good business. As well as over 1,000 plus VBSR members.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation, where this week we're broadcasting live from the UVM Davis Center, which is the site of the 24th annual Spring Conference of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility. And in our second half hour, we're going to have the keynote speaker, who just finished addressing the assembled masses here. Elisa Gravitz is CEO and President of Green America. For nearly 30 years, Elisa has led Green America, which is a national green economy organization, formerly known as Co-op America, and I remember the early newsprint-based catalogs of Co-op America, so it's nice to see its modern incarnation. So Green America is a nonprofit organization that develops marketplace solutions to social and environmental problems with a key focus on tackling climate change, building fair trade systems, stopping corporate abuse, and growing the green economy. Green America's major events and publications include the Green Festivals that happen around the country, the National Green Pages, and Green American, a newsletter. Green America also operates the nation's largest green business and green consumer networks. Elisa Gravitz, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Great to be here.
So you have a national perspective on what we do here locally in Vermont, and in your talk, you alluded to the fact that Vermont has had an impact on the national conversation around sustainable business. You're based in Washington, D.C. Talk a little bit about what is Vermont's contribution to that national dialogue.
Well, you know, there's a famous saying, as Vermont goes, so goes the country, right? my thesis is that Vermont has really been thought leaders on the sustainable business front. Some of the longest and most well-known companies that took on the question of how do you run a business that's socially responsible and environmentally sustainable have come out of Vermont. Companies like Ben & Jerry's, companies like Gardner Supply, these are nationally known companies. And the conversation about, really caring for what is the impact of a company, I think, has been one that's been deep and lively in Vermont, and it is now being picked up across the country. I think it's also because here in Vermont, another important tipping point has happened, where for many years it was about individual companies working on different issues. And now what's happening in Vermont that's so exciting is that now you're looking at whole system approaches. So what do I mean by that? So, for example, there's a deep commitment to local food here. And now there's a question of how do you connect up to make sure that schools and hospitals and restaurants can all plug into that local food system. And so that's also something that now more and more communities around the country are looking at, to go from how do we as individual families, individual businesses make that change, and then how do we sort of join hands together to change a system.
This week in Vermont, Governor Shumlin signed legislation making Vermont the first state to require labeling of GMO foods. What is the significance of that nationally?
It is really important, for the nation can never move unless individuals, communities, and states move first. I mean, that's the way history goes. And it's true of companies, too. There was a question about, the big Walmart question here. When Walmart does something, well, that's big scale. Everybody notices. If Walmart takes growth hormone out, requires there to be no growth hormone in milk, well, then there's, a huge system that follows from that. But Walmart would never do that unless somebody somewhere started that. A company, a dairy, a farm, a grocery store in other parts of the country, that has to come first. And that's the significance. I'm a student of social change, and there's a theory of social change called the crystallization theory. And everybody probably knows about this because they did this experiment when they were in grade school, where you put a salt solution, you create a salt solution, and then you put a string in, and then you put more salt into the water, and then that magic moment happens when crystals form along the string. And everybody goes, oh, this is so exciting, and, because the crystals are beautiful and you can see the impact. But when it comes to social change, it's like that salt solution. The first drop of salt, that first little grain of salt into the solution, is as important as the last drop, because the crystallization, the big impact, would never have happened unless every single grain of salt was in that solution. So that's why it's important, whether it's the first company in Vermont that does something on sustainability, whether it's Vermont being the first state to pass legislation, that shows the model, it shows it can be done, other people get inspiration, and we're back to, as Vermont goes, so goes the nation.
So this week, President Obama went to the corporate headquarters, or maybe it was just a Walmart store. I'm not sure where he was, but it was Walmart. I couldn't help but feel that here he was, kind of going on bended knee in some respect to this corporate tycoon, that is so emblematic of big business in America. You run an organization that is just really trying to move the country in an entirely different direction. How did it make you feel, and what was the significance of President Obama going to address Walmart?
Well, where my organization, Green America, we're a green economy organization, and we're driving for an economy that's socially and environmentally responsible. That means both sides of that equation, social and economic justice, along with community and environmental health. And that's a very big goal that requires many steps. And ultimately, you know, this is a very small planet. We are all in this together. So families, small businesses, and large companies alike, if there's going to be a future for our children, we all have to move in that direction. So my organization does two parts of the social change complex. We put pressure on companies to clean up their act, and we encourage companies and families and communities to adopt socially and environmentally responsible solutions. And, you know, what I always say, people always ask me, well, what's the one most important thing to do when it comes to social change and getting a green economy? And what I always say is, you know what, we need all of the above. We have to create change for it has to be possible for everyone to change and to reach the goal. And so, and we draw from ecosystem science that says the most robust and healthy systems, natural systems, are the ones that are most diverse. So we need a diversity of strategies. So you know what? We need every family to be making good environmental and social justice choices, and we need every company, no matter how large they are, to make them. Having said that, it's very important to encourage companies to do the right thing and to recognize when they do the right thing, and it's very, very important to hold them accountable when they're not doing the right thing. System change proceeds slowly but surely, so I do believe that as all of us keep demanding greater social and environmental responsibilities, these companies will change, and the economic system will change around them. What do I mean by that? The 20th century companies, the business model was all about accumulating wealth and capital, taking stuff out of the earth and taking it away from communities. In the 21st century, the new business models that are emerging are sharing models. I mean, right now, we have things like car sharing, we have like Airbnb. Those are all business models that make it possible for individuals, just like the internet, where we all put information on and get information off, we'll be able to have an economy where we are all producing for the economy as well as being customers of the economy. So those business models, instead of extracting wealth and capital out of the ground and out of communities, will actually will be more democratic. And so we are slowly but surely moving there. And in sometimes big ways, Airbnb, as an example, is now booking more hotel nights than the top five hotel chains combined. So we're getting there.
Mm. You've talked about how the greener the business, the greener the bottom line. Give us some concrete examples of how that's true. And for our audience, we're talking with Elisa Gravitz, CEO and President of Green America, and we're talking to you live from the annual spring conference of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility going on this week at UVM.
Well, let me give you both examples from small businesses and large companies. So on the small business side, we recently completed a really big survey looking at companies all across the country, asking them both about their sustainability practices and their bottom line. And what we found was that the greener the company, the better their bottom line, and that during the recession, they did better in their green products and services. So during the recession, their green products and services actually grew, while their conventional products and services actually declined. We found this in a big way nationwide when it comes to small businesses of companies that are 20 people and under, 20 employees and under. And we found that they reported better dimensions when it came to profitability, when it came to customer loyalty, when it came to sales expansion, all of those measures. What we found was that the companies that had the best social and environmental practices also had the best bottom line. So we found that nationwide in communities that were hard hit by the recession and are still in the recession and in communities that are recovering, that was what went on across the country. Now, let me give you an example from the large company perspective, and I'm going to talk about a renewable energy one, one of my favorite subjects. If you took all of the big utilities, the publicly traded utilities, and last year listed their stock prices from the best-performing stock price to the worst-performing stock price, the best-performing utility got about a 40% stock increase last year, the worst about a 20% stock hit. Those companies in the top 25%, those utility companies, had the highest percentage of renewable energy in their portfolio. In the bottom 25%, they had no renewable energy in their portfolio. So you can see that when you look at these big economic metrics, whether it's from small companies or from very large companies like utilities, the companies that have the best environmental practices are doing the best.
You were showing some statistics saying that green small businesses are succeeding while non-green businesses are falling behind. And some of the things you showed were that the organic food sector has been growing, grew by 238%, but it also showed that it's only 4.2% of the market. How do we break into the remaining 95%?
Well, we are on the way. What we're seeing in all of these sectors, if you had looked 10 years ago, they would have, it would have been little slivers. So when you're having 20, 30, 40% growth per year, at first it is slow, but then you rapidly catch up. So let me give you an example that I think everybody out there would be able to relate to. You know, if I could only see everybody out there and I would ask you to raise your hands, you know, how many of you had cell phones 10 years ago? Well, you know, maybe 5 or 10%. How many have at least one cell phone on them right now? Nearly 100%. That's what happens as you start, when you hit the part where you have this compounded, you know, 20, 30, 40% growth, you're on your way. Let me give you another example. Solar energy right now is probably, depending on how you measure it, maybe 1% of our total energy use in this country right now. But it, like the cell phones, is growing very, very rapidly. And Google has a special unit inside of Google. It's a special unit that looks at trends and disruptive technologies that, by the way, was founded by the it's founded and overseen by the co-founders of Google, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. And they brought in a very famous futurist. His name is Ray Kurzweil, to look at disruptive technologies and what do they think are going to take off. Well, they named solar as one of them. They actually said they believe that by 2025, solar will be generating half of the electricity in this country. So, you know, for those of you who don't yet have your solar panels up, you might say, wow. But, again, think about how quickly cell phones came into this country, and you'll see that even though the green sectors may be in a small percentage right now, they're growing very rapidly. So when we have this conversation in 10 years, we're going to be really excited.
What is the tipping point for sustainable business to no longer carry a special term like sustainable, but it just becomes the mainstream?
That is a really good question. I think that, let's see, maybe we'll go back to the cell phones. People started giving up their landlines about 3 years ago, and that was at the point when cell phones were 60 to 70% of the population. So I'm going to say we're going to need to get up to that 60 to 70%. But the flip side of that is that the opinion leaders, the thought leaders, you know, where the growth is, where the best impacts are, you know, the best positive impacts are, and where the best profitability is going to continue to be in these places where the green and the sustainable is coming together with other technologies and business practices. So that's where the excitement and the growth is going to be.
Is there ever an instance where being sustainable or socially responsible is a liability?
Well, there is a fundamental reality underneath it is that many of the conventional business practices can make more money because they are literally putting the costs onto society. They are not they are not paying their own way. You know, the economists talk about it. They externalize their costs. And so until people say that we're going to do business in a responsible way and not an irresponsible way, there is a fundamental reality that responsible businesses are going to have to pick up more costs. Now, that's where the creativity comes in, because they and it's why companies who are have better social responsibility profiles are able to attract the best graduates and the best capital, is because people want to be where there's the most creative. So you say, huh, well, maybe there's a different way we can design it. If solar energy is still pretty expensive for us, how do we design our building so that we're reducing energy needs lower and lower and lower, so that we can, in fact, put solar on and cover all of our energy needs? So it becomes really interesting questions of making different business models and making different designs, and it's where the fun and creativity is. So at the first blush, you have sometimes being socially responsible costs a little more because you're a small company and you need to build a scale. And sometimes because of these underlying questions of, you know, it really does cost more to be more to account for all your costs. But then you get to that creative design stage where you change the design, you find new ways of doing things, and then that's where you get the full competitive advantage.
So what accounts for the what you cited earlier with sustainable business, sustainable products doing well even as the economy isn't doing so well, whereas conventional products are declining? Why are sustainable products weathering the storm better?
That is another really great question. Let's take the building sector. During the recession, the conventional building sector pretty much tanked. It was down by over 17%. There were almost no new commercial conventional buildings going up. All of the commercial building had green attributes. And I believe it's because the green buildings deliver on several really important things that people want. First of all, if you have a green building, whether you own it or rent it, it costs you less year in, year out, because you're saving energy, you're saving water, so you have a better operating cost perspective. Secondly, people like the buildings better. We talked a minute ago about, well, you have to be more creative, so you know you're designing it differently, you're designing more natural lighting, you're designing more comfortable settings. My goodness gracious, something really revolutionary, you get to open the windows when it's a beautiful day. So people like the buildings better, so they enjoy working there, they enjoy living there better, so you have a better market value for the buildings. So it's an example in many ways of making this investment not only in the environment and not only in saving energy savings, but you're making an investment in better health and well-being for your customers.
So we're talking with Elisa Gravitz, the CEO and President of Green America, and we're talking live from UVM Davis Center, which is where VBSR is holding its 24th annual spring conference. Your organization, also a lot of people work for it, for Green America. It is a business itself. What are the challenges that you face in trying to run a business that is somehow better than a conventional business, or trying to improve the world? And I mean on the nuts and bolts, you know, how do you run the show?
Well, and you know what? That is exactly what sustainability is all about. It's every single family, every single business. Somebody here at the VBSR meeting came up to me and said, well, what was so interesting about your presentation is that it's not only just what green product or service we're going to deliver, but, for example, as a law firm, well, there's not really green law per se, but just like every other business, you know, I own a building, my employees come by car, so we obviously are part of the sustainability equation, even if, for example, we don't make organic food. So we are all part of the sustainability equation, including nonprofit organizations who have their own operations to run. So we had to go through the same discovery steps that everybody does, and we call it a journey to sustainability. You're always learning. There's always new ways to do better. There's always new products and services that come on board that make it easier. So, for example, one small thing, and it's an example of what we call holistic or category thinking. So we decided, for example, when we decided that we were going to print on 100% recycled paper was more expensive in those days. Luckily, not so much the case anymore, but in those days it was probably a good 10 or 20% more. So what did we have to do? Is we had to look at all of our paper usage and figure out, again, how do you design your systems differently? So, you know, that was when we set all of our copiers to automatically print on double sides, because guess what? If you're using 50% less paper, you can afford to pay 10% more on paper and still come out ahead. You know, we looked at all of the publications that we were then printing, which now have pretty much moved online, and we made our paper grades all the same, because the fewer paper grades, the less expensive it was to buy paper. And so there were all kinds of little wonky things like that that helped us do, like you said, the nuts and bolts of sustainability. We also introduced really fun things. One of the things that we do in our office so that people can eat organically and locally and sustainability is we call it the lunch co-op system, where we divide up into groups of five, and one day a week you cook, and the other 4 days a week people cook for you. So that way we can all afford local, organic, sustainable lunches. And guess what? It's the other side of sustainability, the fun side, because those meals are way better than anything we can purchase.
So you all cook for each other at work?
Yeah.
How many people work at your headquarters?
We have about 35 people in our Washington, D.C. office.
So you take one day a week is Elise's lunch day?
The way we do our lunch co-ops is we break up into groups of five so that you're making, you know, for four other people. So it's not like you have to cook for 35 people at once. But it's a system design question. How do you make it easy? The question that we had was, how do we make it easier and affordable for people to be able to eat organic and local? And that was the particular creative design that somebody on my staff came up with. And we now share the recipes because, you know, not everybody thinks of how to make lunch for five people, and now we have recipes for it. So, you know, it becomes, again, it's fun. And like so many other things in the sustainability world, the food tastes better, it's more fun, and it increases communities. You know, we all eat together rather than all go running out at lunchtime. And that's what we're finding across the board. When people go to a farmer's market, they talk to five times more people than they do when they go to the grocery store. Total strangers. You make community connections, and it's more fun.
So the journey to sustainability and to making a better world is often one step forward, one step back. And, you know, if we focus too much on Washington, we feel like it's always steps back, but then when we look at our local scene of Vermont, we feel like there's progress. What is something that you feel proudest of in the work that you've done in this world, in this sphere?
In this sphere. Well, and I just really want to support that. One of the reasons why I work in this sphere, why Green America exists, is because we work in the economy, the green economy. We believe that the economy moves much faster than politics. We have to lead. So, you know, things like Dolphin Safe Tuna is an example of where if that happened 20 years ago, if we were trying to get it through Congress, we would still be waiting for it. So the market can move quickly. I think the thing that I am really excited about is some of the changes we've made with very large companies. Just this year, General Mills agreed to make Cheerios non-GMO. 2 years ago, Hershey agreed to monitor their entire cocoa supply chain so that by 2020, they are going to be able to demonstrate that there's no forced child labor in the cocoa supply chain. We have a really big campaign out there right now that I would love to invite everyone to our website. We make these changes with companies when people sign in on those petitions. They really do work. We have a bad apple campaign out there because in the electronic supply chain in China, there is a people are being exposed to benzene and other chemicals, and we can put a stop to that. It would cost less than $1 per iPhone. Apple can do it overnight.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave it there. Lisa Gravitt, CEO of Green America, thanks for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks for all you do to get these stories out there.
That's the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. Today on locally owned and operated 96.1 WDEV FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier.
AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. More than 240 miners are dead. A number of others still trapped in a Turkish coal mine after an explosion and fire. The tragedy is